We're now officially over halfway through the book. Isn't that good? Isn't that good news? Only a year more. Maybe a little more. Revelation 13 is where we find ourselves. Revelation 13 is a description of the coming Antichrist and the false prophet who will assist the Antichrist under the authority of Satan just before the Lord Jesus returns to the earth in final judgment. In his first epistle, the Apostle John, who writes the book of Revelation as well, John expects that an individual will come who is identified as Antichrist. 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, John says, "Children, it is the last hour, and just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have appeared." So John knows that those who are reading his epistle have already heard about Antichrist, and indeed they had, because the Old Testament is full of descriptions of the coming Antichrist. So those who are reading John's letter, they know. And John reminds them, even now there are many Antichrists that have appeared. And from this we know that it is the last hour. He goes on to say in verse 19 of 1 John 2, "They," these antichrists, "went out from us, but they were not really of us. Because if they had been of us, they would have remained with us, but they went out so that it would be shown that they are all not of us." According to John, antichrists have some prior connection to the Christian church, but they have departed, they have left, they have revealed themselves to be false teachers, antichrists, opposed to Christ, because they have left the Christian faith. John says, many, many have appeared. And that was in the end of the first century, many have appeared. We're 2,000 years removed from that. Many, many have appeared. And yet there is still a single Antichrist, as John says. Antichrist is coming. There's a single Antichrist that is anticipated. In his fairly new commentary, Tom Schreiner, he's a New Testament scholar, has an entire excursus where he starts tracing through church history all of the suppositions, or many of the suppositions, as to who the Antichrist has been through church history. I thought I'd give them to you today. Irenaeus in the second century, just after the writing of the book of Revelation, Irenaeus in the second century identified the beast that we're reading about here in Revelation 13 as the coming Antichrist that John speaks of. Hippolytus, the bishop of Rome in the third century, described the beast of the sea as the Roman Empire, and the beast of the earth that we'll talk about later in this chapter as the Antichrist. Tertullian in the third century believed that the fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7 verse 7 was the Roman Empire, and he also saw that the empire was the restrainer of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 before the arrival of the Antichrist. Origen in the third century, as he was prone to do, he generalized the Antichrist into a symbolic concept, seeing the presence of the Antichrist wherever lies and untruth are present. That's Antichrist. Other third century writers like Commodian and Victorinus linked the beast of Revelation 13 with Nero. That's interesting, because in the third century, Nero had been dead for 200 years. So they believed in a Nero redivivus, that is, a revived Nero who would come back. That is, that Nero had committed suicide. He'd stuck a knife into his neck and killed himself, and many thought that Nero had not actually died, and he was off somewhere in some hidden part of the world building an army, and these writers believed that Nero would be revived and come back as the Antichrist. Cyril, in the fourth century, that'd be the 300s, saw that the Antichrist had magical, miraculous powers, and he argued that the Antichrist would actually rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, and thus one way to identify the Antichrist is from the reconstruction of the temple. That's an idea that goes all the way back to the 300s. Jerome in the 5th century claimed that the Antichrist would be Jewish, and he would be virgin born, and that his demise would come on the Mount of Olives. In the 5th century, the expositor Chrysostom believed that the Antichrist would be a man, even though Satan would be working inside of him. Augustine in the 5th century, along with Jerome, emphasized that many antichrists that precede the final antichrist would come. And Augustine also stressed that the antichrist functions manifest themselves in false teaching, in doctrine that strays from orthodoxy. As the papacy grew from the 6th century and 7th century on, there were many, many accusations that the Pope himself would be the Antichrist, especially when you come to the time of the Reformation in the 16th century. You have people like John Wycliffe and Martin Luther who were very boldly proclaiming that the Pope himself was the Antichrist. You can only imagine the Catholic response. The Catholics responded by saying, no, indeed Martin Luther is the Antichrist. Catholics in the 1600s began to adopt what's called a preterist interpretation of the book of Revelation. A preterist interpretation of Revelation sees all of the account of Revelation, or at least the majority of the account of Revelation, as being fulfilled and completed within the first century. Many Protestants began to follow suit with that in the 1600s. In the early 1900s, some Russians claimed that the Tsar was Antichrist, as you can imagine. Isaac Newton, who was himself a Roman Catholic, and many Protestant English Puritans taught that the Catholic Church and the Pope were the Antichrist. Some, when he arose, claimed that Napoleon was the Antichrist. According to Tom Schreiner, in the 20th century, little interest was shown in the Antichrist except by futurists. Futurists are, as opposed to preterists, futurists think the book of Revelation points to what's going to happen in the future. And he notes that among scholars, there wasn't a lot of interest in the 20th century about who the Antichrist was, except if you believe that the book of Revelation was pointing to the future. And so a host of suggestions as to who the Antichrist might be arose. Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Henry Kissinger, Mikhail Gorbachev, Pope John Paul II, and Barack Obama. In the middle and the late 1990s, there was a local pastor in my hometown who had international acclaim in his ministry, and he was very definitive in his preaching through the book of Revelation that Prince Charles, now King Charles, was indeed the Antichrist, and he proved it from Scripture. As we've seen, some have pointed out even, and Schreiner notes this, that the names of Ronald Wilson Reagan each has six letters so that it accords with 666. Reagan was the Antichrist, and all of God's people said, probably not, right? Probably, if you're given to watching incessant YouTube conspiracy videos, you're going to be convinced by just about anything that comes out these days. So in light of all of that through church history, this morning I want to actually tell you who the Antichrist is. No, I'm not going to give you a name. I'm not going to give you a name of anybody in the present or the future, nor am I going to reach back to the past to find a name to say this indeed is the Antichrist, because the Bible itself does not do that. So I'm going to avoid doing that. Your mind might wonder, and so it should. The Antichrist is coming, and many Antichrists have come. So we would assume that some of the characteristics that we talk about today in regard to of the Antichrist, we would see throughout church history, and we would see many of these characteristics perhaps in world leaders today, whether we can point to one of them being the Antichrist or not, I would warn you to be careful, just simply aware and mindful of interpreting or misinterpreting your present circumstances or future ideas. Some suggest if the rapture removed the church, then why even worry about it? I remember John MacArthur making the statement. He said, listen, if I'm wrong about the rapture, I'm still not going through the tribulation. He said, I'm going to go right up to the Antichrist, preach the gospel, and he'll kill me on the spot. So I'm still not going to go through it. So maybe you don't have to worry about it. But you should be mindful because these antichrists, even the Apostle John said, the one who's coming is going to be mimicked by many others. We're going to see this throughout history. We should be mindful of it so that we're not duped by it. The Bible actually expects us to know these things. It spends a healthy amount of time teaching us about these characteristics, so we should know about it. And church historians and church leaders throughout church history have been discussing these very details in regard to the Antichrist. This is not something new. This is not some newfangled theological idea that arose in the 1900s. This has been going on from the beginning of the church. The reality is that world powers connected to false religious systems aiming for global domination have existed from the beginning of human history. And figures like those who lead those kinds of empires have sought to eradicate the people of God from the very beginning. Pharaoh in the Exodus, Sennacherib of Assyria, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, Cyrus of Persia, Antiochus Epiphanes of Greece, and many of the emperors of Rome all sought to persecute the Jewish people or Christians in an aim to attain to some kind of global power. And since the coming of Christ, we have witnessed the rise of many such antichrist figures, just as John said we would see. But as John indicated, there is one who is coming, and he will supersede them all. He will be the final figure in world history that actually finds his judgment coming from the Lord Jesus Christ when Christ comes back to the earth in final judgment. This is not a new idea. This is an idea that goes all the way back into the Old Testament. The prophet Daniel described him this way in Daniel chapter 7, verse 7. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. And it had large iron teeth, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little horn. This is how Daniel describes the coming Antichrist. A little horn among the many came up among them. And three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. That's how Daniel described the coming Antichrist. Connected with the fourth beast, the one that gains the attention of the Son of Man. We'll look at it a little more in just a moment. In Daniel chapter 9, verses 26 and 27, he described the coming Antichrist with the phrase, the prince who is to come. And he is the prince who is to come, and he would bring about what was known as the abomination of desolation. Jesus noted, when you see the abomination of desolation, that Daniel talked about in Daniel chapter 9, verses 26 to 27, those in Judea should flee into the wilderness because the wrath of God had come. Interesting that when Jesus pointed to that era, he even said many false Christs will be coming during that era, just like John told us. Paul described this coming Antichrist as the man of lawlessness. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, if you remember our series a few years ago, we were studying this in detail. 2 Thessalonians 2:8, he will be revealed whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. So there is a man connected with sin and lawlessness who will exist when the Lord Jesus returns, and the Lord Jesus will slay that man. This man whom Jesus will defeat when he returns will first, according to the Apostle Paul, oppose and exalt himself above every so-called god or object of worship so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God, 2 Thessalonians 2:4. Paul further notes that this man of lawlessness, this son of destruction, is currently restrained until the Lord removes the restrainer. And the restrainer is some kind of personality, whether it be an angelic being, which would be my supposition, that some kind of spiritual power, likely an angelic power, is restraining this spiritual force that will be and literally possess the man of lawlessness when he is revealed. What all this means is that the satanic spiritual activity that will one day fuel the final Antichrist has been operative in the world for many, many millennia. But there will be a specific time when this ruler is revealed. We're told that in the Bible. We're told that in Daniel chapter 9, again in verse 27. It's a critical text. It actually tells us when the man of lawlessness, when the little horn, when the son, the prince, the coming prince will come. It says in Daniel 9:27 that he, this coming prince, will make a firm covenant with the many. The many in the context of Daniel 9 is Israel. He'll make a firm covenant with the many for one period of seven. That's the literal Hebrew rendering. One period of seven. And in the Bible, seven, when it's talking about time, either refers to days or years. And in this context, years makes the most sense. And where years are mentioned, it all plays out specifically and accurately. So for 1 week or 1 7, but in the middle of the seven, the middle of that 7 year period that this coming prince makes a firm covenant with Israel, in the middle of that seven, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. There's the abomination of desolation. When will it happen? Midway through the final 7 year period. He's revealed when he makes that covenant in that final 7 year period with Israel. And in the middle of that period, he will come against the temple in Jerusalem, break the covenant, bring about the abomination of desolation. And it is that middle period of that 7 year stretch that the book of Revelation has been circling around as we've been talking since chapter 6. It's really a final period, 1260 days, 42 months, time, times and a half time. That's the historical biblical outline of what we see regarding the man of lawlessness or the coming Antichrist. And there's even more. If you read through Daniel chapter 11, there's even more explicit information of which we'll look in the future. But in Revelation 13, we find even greater detail. Even more detail. Evidently, the Lord thinks we need to know more about this coming man of lawlessness. Perhaps it is so that we could look at our times and see the trajectory of our times, and we could see that the time is coming near for the Lord to return, and we can warn those who are outside of the faith. Maybe it is so that we don't misinterpret what's going on around us and think that, like the Thessalonians, we're in the day of the Lord. But here is a host of detail describing this future final coming Antichrist. This is a description that comes on the heels of what we saw last time when Satan is so frustrated with his inability to annihilate Israel because of God's providential protection of her, that we begin to see an expression of his rage that is unparalleled. And it's that final earthly expression of satanic rage that we begin to look at in Revelation 13. Verses 1 to 10 is going to describe a beast that comes out of the sea. And we'll look at the meaning of that. That is that final Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, the little horn, the coming prince. In verses 11 to 18, we'll see a beast described that comes out of the earth, an individual later called in the book of Revelation the false prophet who assists the beast or the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, in deceiving the world through a false religious system to follow and worship the Antichrist and ultimately to worship Satan himself. And it will be these two that Jesus initially destroys when he returns. We'll see that as well in chapter 19. When Jesus actually returns, the aim of his wrath hits first the beast of the sea, then the beast of the earth, and they're cast into the lake of fire that burns forever and ever. So this morning, we're going to start looking at the characteristics of the coming Antichrist. Characteristics, because that's what's listed. Not a name, Not a person we're going to point to in our society and say, this is him. Many, many people have done that. I've got some great books on my shelf. They've got all kinds of supposition about that. You pull them off and you say, well, that's interesting, and it's obviously false because that person's dead and has been dead a long time. Many, many people have tried to guess. There's no reason to guess. It's just right to know what to expect so that you live in a confident way. You don't lack confidence, and you're not blown around by what you read in the newspaper. There's stable confidence. So what we're going to look at over the course of our study of this chapter are 12 different characteristics of the coming Antichrist. We're not going to get to all 12 today. And all of God's people now said, amen. Yes, I know. I know what's coming. Lunch is out there. We're ready for you. But we'll start into it. So let's look at the first of these characteristics of the coming Antichrist. First, the Antichrist will be an ungodly ruler. We know that, but that's where the text begins. That's where John begins. In the vision that he sees, this is an ungodly ruler. He's a powerful ruler, and he's filled with ungodliness. Verse 1, and the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. Satan is standing on the sand of the seashore, and he's frustrated. He has not been able, as we saw last week, to conquer Israel in the latter portion of what we call the Great Tribulation. He's not been successful to overcome Israel nor the saints. He's turned his ire on all those who would follow God in this time period. And so to express his final rage, he stands on the sand of the seashore, and it's as if he's calling out of the sea this beast of the sea. Let's notice that this Antichrist, who is an ungodly ruler, has a very evil origin. He is connected to the dragon. This is the person associated with the beast. He's calling this beast up. So whoever this is connected to Satan, the devil. The way the sentence is arranged in the Greek text, the phrase out of the sea is actually the emphasis of the sentence, out of the sea. We're supposed to wonder, what is this sea? What is the sea that's referred to here? Well, you remember back in chapter 12, verse 1, when we're told that we're seeing several signs. These signs have biblical images connected to them. We've seen the dragon is Satan, the woman is Israel, the wings of the eagle are God's supernatural deliverance of Israel. So the sea is likely another one of these biblical images. How are we to see that and understand what the sea is? Well, in the ancient world, the sea was often thought of as one commentator put it, the reservoir of evil. You can consider a biblical passage that refers to a supernatural evil being that finds its home in the sea. You remember we looked at this a few weeks ago in Job chapter 41. Job chapter 41, I think, is a description of, we could say, is a description of Satan. And he's described in Job 41 as with the term Leviathan. You remember that? You say, well, how do you know it's Satan? Well, at the end of the chapter, it says of him in verse 34, he looks on everything that is high, and he, this Leviathan, is the king over all the sons of pride. He's the most proud. He's the ruler of the proud. This is not just a physical beast of the earth. This is likely a person, has a personality, and he's the ruler over all those who are proud. This is likely the devil. Well, where did he come from? Well, if you look at the beginning of Job 41, the language is interesting. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? What does that mean? Where is he? He's in the sea. Or can you press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Verse 7 of Job 41, can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Why? Because he's in the water, he's in the sea. Or verse 31, he makes the depths, that's a reference to the sea, he makes the depths boil like a pot, he makes the sea like a jar of ointment. This is an indication that the devil himself, the king of all those who are proud, comes out of the sea. You say, so is the water bad? Well, it's an image. And what is it an image of? We actually don't have to wonder about that because we've already in the book of Revelation seen a reference to the beast that comes out of the sea. Do you remember it? Turn back to Revelation 11 for a moment. It was the first time that he was mentioned in the entire book. Revelation 11, verse 7. Describing the two witnesses that are to come, in verse 7 it says, when they have finished their testimony. Notice this, the beast that comes up out of what? The abyss. The abyss. You say, what is the abyss? That's the bottomless pit. Look over at Revelation 17, 8, just for a moment. Revelation 17, 8, describing the beast that comes out of the sea in chapter 13. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come out of where? The abyss. If the sea is another one of these biblical signs, it's a sign to the place of which Satan dwells, Leviathan. It's the place where Satan governs. If you remember Revelation chapter 9 and verse 1, when the fifth angel sounded, there was a star that fell from heaven. It had fallen to the earth, and it had the key of the abyss. This was a reference to Satan. He rules over the abyss. This is the place of his dominion in this period, during this time, and he rules over the abyss. And we looked at that. The abyss is the place where the worst of the demonic hordes were kept until the end of time, when they would be unleashed by Satan under God's authority as a means of judgment on the earth. So the beast out of the sea is also the beast that comes out of the abyss. And the abyss is the place connected with Satan, just like you see in Job chapter 41. So the sea is likely the abyss, the worst place of the demonic beings. So Satan, in his frustration, stands again at the abyss, like he did in Revelation chapter 9, verse 1. He stands at the abyss, and he essentially calls forth this beast out of the sea. And this beast is an individual, in connection with the false prophet, we'll see, who is the one that Jesus will slay when he returns. Revelation 19, 19, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies. This is one of the ways we know the beast has a kingdom, yes, but he's in addition to kings. It's an individual, not just a kingdom. He has a kingdom, but it's an individual who rules over a kingdom. The beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him, that is Christ, who sat on the horse, and against his army, and the beast was seized. And with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. This is exactly what the Apostle Paul said in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. This beast, this man of lawlessness, would be the one whom the Lord would slay when he returns. That's how we identify him, as the man of lawlessness, the man of sin. So just as the dragon was a single being, so is the beast. It's a being, a person. Not just merely a demonic being, but a man. And no doubt a demonically possessed and controlled individual. He has an evil origin. So whatever you look at about this person, his origin is evil, meaning his entire character is opposed to God. We also note in verse 1 of Revelation 13 that He commands a global organization. This is another aspect of this ungodly ruler. He has a global organization. How do we know that? Well, look at the description. This beast that comes out of the sea has 10 horns and 7 heads. On his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. What is that? Well, again, they're signs, but they're biblical signs. You can find them in the Bible. Where do you find that in the Bible? Turn back to Daniel chapter 7 just for a moment. I want us to read through a significant section here, just so you see where this is coming from. This is a vision that Daniel had as well. Daniel chapter 7. Look at verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. And Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Sound familiar? And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. And the first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. And I kept looking until its wings were plucked. That's what we wanted to see about eagles, right? In light of the past few weeks. But it was lifted up from the ground, you'll get there later, the ground, and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was given it. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. And after this, I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird, and the beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast. And we saw this just a moment ago. We read it. Dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth that devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had, how many horns? 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. Jump down to verse 15. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me. I mean, you can imagine, can't you? This is one bad dream. This is a bad dream. You've had bad dreams, but this is a bad, bad dream. My spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. These great beasts, which are 4 in number, are 4 kings who will arise from the earth. That's not hard to understand, is it? Who are the beasts? Well, they're kings. They're earthly rulers. But, verse 18, the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. You say, so these beasts do not come, these beasts who came out of the sea in Daniel's vision, they come out of an evil origin, but they will not overcome the saints eventually. The saints will eventually possess the kingdom. Verse 19, then I desired to know the exact meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which 3 of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. And I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. Obviously, it's a king, it's a ruler, and he's waging war against the saints, and he's actually overcoming them. We saw that last week when We notice that the dragon makes war with the saints and he does overcome them. Verse 22, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. We actually see that in the book of Revelation. When will the saints take possession of the kingdom? When the king arrives and takes care of the beasts, and he hands over the kingdom to the saints in Revelation 19 and 20. Verse 23 says, thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour how much of the earth? The whole earth, and tread it down and crush it. And as for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. And another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and he'll subdue the three kings, and he'll speak out against the Most High, and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and a half time. There's that interesting language again. When will this all happen? At the end, just before the Lord returns. Then, the sovereignty, verse 27, the sovereignty, the dominion, the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints, because the Lord will have come in judgment and annihilated and destroyed that beast, and it'll be given to the saints. So what is John seeing in Revelation 13 when he sees a beast coming out of this sea having 10 horns? He's seeing what Daniel saw. What are the 10 horns? They're kingdoms and kings. 10 diadems, rulers. It's not difficult to see what this is. It is a lot to take in, that is for sure. But that fourth beast is different from all of the other kingdoms. Revelation 17 gives us another description of this. In Revelation 17, verse 8, he tells us the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction, and those who dwell on the earth whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will wonder when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. And here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads or seven mountains on which this woman, that is Babylon, that's a system that he will rule, sits. And there are seven kings. Here it is again. There's seven kings. And from John's perspective, when he writes this, he says, five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. This is exactly what Daniel was seeing. And from John's perspective, he says these seven are kings. Five of them have already come. And we'll look at this later, but it's likely the kingdoms of Egypt and Assyria and Babylon and Greece and Rome. That's the kingdom that is, because that's the kingdom that was during John's day. But there's one that is coming after that. And it will remain a little while. Well, how long is a little while? Time, times, and a half time. Verse 11 says, the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom. So they're coming in the future. But they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. You say, well, how long is 1 hour? About the length of one sermon. These have one purpose, and they give one sermon here. Let's just say it that way. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. So John tells us the same thing that Daniel tells us, that these horns coming from this beast are kingdoms. What does all that mean? Well, this is an evil ruler. He's an evil ruler who rules over a multitude of kingdoms, and these kingdoms actually rule over the entire earth at the end of time. He has an evil origin. He's a ruler over the world. But also notice at the end of verse 1, He has a blasphemous identity. On his heads were blasphemous names. They're not just, these kingdoms that are represented here are not just holding allegiance to the beast. They are opposed to God. That's what blasphemy is. It's opposition to God. Not just contrary to God, it opposes everything that God stands for. I want you to think of this. There's coming a time when one man will rule through a multitude of kingdoms who actually stand against everything that we believe is true in the scripture. That's the prediction of what is to come. So again, when you look at the world and where it's moving, you don't see the world becoming more like disciples of Jesus, do you? We see disciples of Jesus being made. We see the church in many places. We see the church flourishing, but we also see the world. It's interesting to see the world now. You can actually see the trends of the entire world today. You pull it out of your pocket and you can read the news in real time. You see video that comes out in real time. You're seeing a kind of opposition that's growing across the world. It's not hard to imagine this kind of thing. And again, this leader who hates God will seek to be a replacement for God, because the name of his entire kingdom, his realm, all that he rules over stands against God. He has many blasphemous names. He hates God. At least the God of the Bible. I do think he's going to be religious. I do think he's going to try to mimic the true God, but he hates the true God. So that's the first characteristic, actually. I know that was a lot, but there's a lot in verse 1. He's an ungodly ruler. An ungodly ruler. Let's look at a second characteristic. Secondly, the Antichrist will wield fierce power. Fierceness is the emphasis. Where do we get that? The first part of verse 2. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Again, these are images that Daniel gave us back in Daniel chapter 7, when Daniel described nations that would come. Daniel chapter 7 described a lion in verse 4, who was also like a man who had human authority. Verse 5 of Daniel 7 described a bear who would arise and devour much meat. He had the authority to conquer, incredible power. In verse 6 of Daniel 7, there was a king who was like a leopard, that is, swift and fierce. Our mind is meant to go back to these images in Daniel. And in Daniel 7, those kingdoms likely did refer to the kingdoms of Babylon and Persia and Greece. Well, the final beast that we're seeing here, did you notice the language? It's like a leopard. It's as the bear. It's as the lion. It's like those kingdoms. This one is like all the previous kingdoms. When you look at world history, you see predominant kingdoms rise, like Egypt, like Babylon and Assyria and Persia. You see these kingdoms rise and they look to conquer the world. Rome was one of those. And this leader will be like that. And in all the fierceness, power, and authority that was seen in those previous world powers, you're going to see in this final world leader. There will be a degree of fierce power that comes from him. There's a third characteristic. At the end of verse 2, he will possess satanic authority. Satanic authority. It says at the end of verse 2, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't that fascinating? The God of this world is who? Satan. He's the prince of the power of the air that is now working in the sons of disobedience, according to Ephesians 2. And he's going to take his throne and his power and his authority, which means he has the ability to rule over the entire world. What did we see in the book of Job? When Satan presented himself to God, and he said, I think if you gave me Job, I can turn him. And God said, have him. And so what did he command? He commanded nations, he commanded nature, he commanded people to do his bidding, because he's the God of this world. So this coming Antichrist, this coming man of sin, this prince, this little horn will have global power, and he will have all of the authority of Satan himself over the world. Not over a region, over the world. He'll have all of that authority. Whatever Satan can do, this man will be able to do. Which leads to the fourth characteristics we'll look at. He will exert supernatural attraction. He will exert supernatural attraction. Verse 3, I saw one of his heads as if it had been, and the word is slaughtered. It's the same word used of the lamb in chapter 5, the slaughtered lamb, killed, slain. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain. That is, one of these kings, likely the greatest king, the little horn that Daniel speaks of, that rises up against all the others. He was slaughtered. It's a fatal wound. His fatal wound was then what? Healed. And the whole earth was amazed. They marveled. That's the term. They marveled. They were amazed. And they went after the beast. They went after him. This is really interesting. There's a deeply religious feel here to all of this. This is something spiritual that would cause people not only to be in awe of an individual, but to actually begin to worship this individual as if he were God. This fatal wound that is healed must be so dramatic and linked to something so spiritual that it actually brings people to worship, because that's the term that is eventually used. They worship this beast. It inspires people to consider him a god. In Revelation 17:8, you note it, we read it just a moment ago, he's described as the beast that was and is not. It's likely some kind of sign that this person, this individual, was killed and yet was then resurrected. An idea of being murdered and resurrected. Why call him the Antichrist? Because he's just the perfect mimic of Christ. Killed and resurrected. I mean, what would get the attention of the world? What would cause the world to begin to think, this is someone godlike? If there's actual resurrection, because it says the whole earth was amazed and they followed after him. Whatever this healing was, it was so dramatic that it made the world think, this is someone we must follow. We must go after. It's not a fabled healing. It's not like Nero who killed himself and there were thoughts that he might come back as a revived emperor. No. The world knows that he was dead and the world sees that he has been made alive. They become aware of it. You say, well, who accomplishes that? Well, all of the authority of the dragon was given to this beast, was it not? You say, well, can the devil raise the dead? The devil can do supernatural things. Things that look and appear very supernatural. We shouldn't be shocked by that. Do you remember Pharaoh's sorcerers? They didn't mimic Moses' acts. They duplicated them. They did something supernatural because of the supernatural activity that was in them, likely because it had a satanic origin. By the way, Jesus said about these days in Matthew 24:23, says, if anyone says to you, during this time of great tribulation, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. I mean, can you imagine if someone was raised from the dead, someone might say, there's the Christ, there he is. Jesus says, don't believe him, because false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even who? The elect. The elect. Paul says of the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2:9, his coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders. Meaning these wonders aren't pointing to the truth. These wonders are pointing to evil so as to mislead. False wonders. And he says, with all deception of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. The whole world is going to buy into it. They'll believe it. It'll be that dramatic. So this coming world leader who has an evil origin, an ungodly leader who possesses satanic authority, he's going to have a supernatural attraction to the world. Look at a fifth characteristic with me in verse 4. He will command exclusive worship. Verse 4. They worship the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? Isn't that what you would say of someone if they were supernaturally raised from the dead? How do you kill this guy? If he was dead and now he's alive, how do you wage war against that? And if he's connected to the dragon, he's connected to the dragon in some religious way, the world then begins to worship him. That's the language that's used. They worship him. They see the supernatural attraction through the man of lawlessness and they begin to worship him. He commands this kind of exclusive worship. It first is a worship of the dragon. They worship the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. There's no hidden connection between the dragon and the beast. There's no hidden connection between the Antichrist and Satan. It's obvious. By the way, what has Satan always wanted? He's always wanted to be worshiped. You remember the temptation of the Lord Jesus in Matthew chapter 4? The devil took Jesus to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world. How could he do that? Well, he's the ruler of this world. He's the God of this world. He showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give to you. Can you imagine saying that to the Son of God? I'll give you all these things. They belong to the Son of God. But at this time, they're under Satan's dominion. I'll give them to you if you fall down and what? Worship me. He's always wanted this. He's always wanted the world and the kingdoms of the world to worship him. And now through this individual, he gets it. He'll get it. The world will worship Satan because the world will see that it was Satan who was the source of the Antichrist's resurrection. That's not hard for me to believe at all. Our world is enamored with power. Our world is enamored with authority. Our world is enamored with personalities who want to wield excessive influence. We follow influencers. They tell us what to look like and wear and what's good and bad. And the world just follows. Can you imagine if there was actually something out there that had seeming substance to it, like resurrection and supernatural power? And the world is eager for this. We see it in politics today. The morality of the politician means very little to the average person today. Just produce for a constituency what the constituency wants, and it really doesn't matter how you live. Just give them what they want. People will give their allegiance to whatever appears powerful enough to provide them what they want. And the whole earth is ripe for this. This isn't hard to believe at all. They worship the beast because they say, who's like him? There's no one like him. Let's finish this morning with a sixth characteristic. Well, we'll see. We might get two more in. We'll see. One, he will promote his exaltation. Let's see if we can get through verse 5. There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words. The Greek text, it's mega words. Mega words, big words. Everything about him, when he talks, he's always talking about things that are big. Mega. I didn't say MAGA, I said mega. Big words. And blasphemies. Massive boasts about what he can accomplish, who he is, how great he is. That's what arrogant words are. He is the one who can accomplish world peace. He is the one who can accomplish great things. Big words. And blasphemies. If he can accomplish this, he rivals who? He supersedes who? God. Again, Satan wants worship. He'll achieve it through this one who gains the worship of the world, who boasts of such great things that puts himself in opposition to God. It's blasphemies. Paul said of the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2:4, he opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Many antichrists have done that kind of thing. The final one will do it in the most extreme way. He promotes his own exaltation. Again, that's what Satan has done all along. When Satan fell, he fell because he was trying to lift himself up. Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 17, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. Isaiah 14, 13, of Satan himself, but you said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens. Big words. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. Blasphemous words. And I'll sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I'll be the reigning king over the earth. Remember what is said of Leviathan, Job 41. He looks on everything that is high. He is the king of all the sons of pride. Big words, blasphemous words. Yeah, let me give you one last characteristic and we'll finish because it's short and it's obvious. End of verse 5. Number 7, he'll have a limited reign. He has authority, but he has a limited authority. This reminds me of the book of Job. You can do this to this level. You can go to this degree, but no more. So he has authority to act for 42 months. How long is 42 months? It's 3.5 years, 1,260 days. That's the extent of it, 3.5 years. Which should remind you, thanks be to God, it's limited. It should remind you, he isn't sovereign. There's diadems, kings, kingdoms, power, but it's limited because there is one reigning king over even this king. I want you to think through those characteristics. The coming Antichrist, he's going to be an ungodly ruler, possesses satanic authority. He exerts supernatural attraction. He commands exclusive worship. He promotes his own exaltation. He'll have a divinely limited reign, 42 months. I think if you looked over church history and you looked at people who could wield this kind of power, you would say it'd be hard to see that the whole globe could come under the sway of someone just like this. But it's not hard to see that. It's not difficult to imagine that today. It is fascinating, and I encourage you to watch carefully where you see evangelical Christianity going right now. It is amazing to me to see how enamored with personality and celebrity evangelical culture is. I'm not talking about false religions out there. I'm talking about evangelical Christians. We love names and we want to know names. We want to be close to names. We want to drop names because we, even in our evangelical circles, that means something to us. We want to be close to that. That's at heart satanic. There's nothing good about that. There's something we need to be satisfied. We're here. We're in Lee's Summit at this church. We have these people are our people. We're not here to try to conquer the world. We're not here to try to solve all the world's problems that we see on Twitter or whatever you call it today. Facebook is not our kingdom. It's us here in this. We're living out our Christian life here with one another. We don't need a lot of personalities, and personalities coming across the pulpit here are not that important. Being faithfully led in the word week after week and trying to live out the Christian life together, that's what's important. But the evangelical world is enamored with populism. And so is our culture. So is our culture. The evangelical culture, not just popular, there is this enamored view of even the supernatural. You see it in the charismatic world, the prosperity gospel that promises you all of these things and all of these wonderful supernatural events that get global attraction. It's growing. It's not diminishing. It's growing. If you look at other parts of the world, it's expanding in a massive way. And if you watched political systems, they just shift on a dime today, depending on who can exert the greatest amount of influence and promote policy positions that will gain them leadership positions. If you can give me leadership, if you can give me influence, I'll follow you. That's politics today. And politicians will embrace any form of religion that they think will get their followers to come with them. I was appalled when Donald Trump created a faith office earlier this month and put a false teacher, Paula White, as the leader of it, a prosperity preacher. And we watched Southern Baptists and evangelical leaders praise her books, praise her leadership skills, praise the president for appointing her. If you think that what we're seeing is some progress of Christianity in America through the present presidential administration, you are sorely mistaken. We should never expect that from such sources. It comes from the church alone, alone. And we're just watching the world follow along. So when such a man comes, we'll watch the world walk away from Christ so easily because we're enamored with so many other things. This is why we better learn to love the scriptures and love the Lord of the scriptures and to help one another walk faithfully with the Lord of the scriptures, because if it were not for the grace of God, our hearts will go astray as well. And we simply want to walk faithfully with Christ and each other.